Okay, this hour we will take your phone calls with Paula Harris and Kim Arnold. Incredible story here, so get ready on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Kim, we were talking a little bit about the United Airlines case right there where they spotted the same saucers. Go ahead, I'll let you finish that up before we go to calls.
Well, no, it's real quick. You know, it happened on July 4th, which was very interesting. Apparently Roswell happened on July 4th too, but over here in over Emmett, Idaho, you know, Captain E.J. Smith, a pilot of United Airlines, he and his co-pilot, Ralph Stevens, and his stewardess, Marty Morrow, they all saw UFOs following their craft for 15 minutes. So, of course, my dad became good friends with him. You know, pilots are respectable people.
Here's an email in for you, Kim, from George Smith in Bend, Oregon. Listen to this. George, my mother, Mildred Bernice Boyce, worked for Kenneth Arnold many years ago, I believe, in Boise, Idaho, as a housekeeper. Don't know the exact dates or details. I don't know if Kim knew her or not. He gave her an autographed copy of his book, which I had for years, and I donated it for a good cause. Just wanted you to know. So, maybe, huh?
I don't know. I mean, that sounds like an interesting story.
You never know. Paula?
You know, George, I was just thinking, you know, here are all these witnesses, even as early as 1947, and my good friend Monsignor Balducci said that an entire religion was founded on witness testimony, and he was talking about the, you know, Jesus and the apostles, that was founded on witness testimony, and he didn't understand why, with all these witnesses, these credible people, that people did not believe in UFOs.
You know, this entire field seems to be getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And, you know, with people like Kim coming forward, talking about what they went through and everything else. You know, I never knew that that Kenneth Arnold thought this was all biological. I mean, I thought that he thought, oh, my gosh, UFOs, flying saucers, ETs. But
no,
not at all.
Well, you know, George, he was kind of hesitant to even say his theory and what he kind of believed towards the end of his life. You know, he only told a journalist in 1982, 2 years before he died.
What did he die of, Kim, if I can ask
cancer
you?
Cancer of the colon.
Oh,
yeah, he
my
died
God.
Of cancer. Uh-huh.
69.
Right, he was 68 when he died.
Yeah, yeah. Almost 69.
Uh-huh.
Way too young.
Well, you know what, George, to be honest with you, I think my mother and I kind of discussed it. I mean, his life was so stressful being such a famous man. Everybody thinks, you know, that it's just a bed of roses because you become famous. Well, you know, it really doesn't turn out to be quite that way. It almost makes your life more difficult.
In those days, the media was, they were all over him. So he probably was a household word, wasn't he?
Oh, well, you know, of course, the word flying saucer now. You know what is really incredible, George? My father started everything. Paula wouldn't even be here today if it wasn't for my father.
That's right.
He started it all.
Yeah, he did.
He was the man who started it all. And, you know, he kind of referred to himself as kind of the unfortunate goat.
Yeah, well, he didn't know. He didn't know he was going to start it all.
Oh, heavens, no.
But he did.
Well, he didn't. You know, he did it so innocently. You know, he thought he was just coming forth, and he thought that the government would have an explanation for what he saw. And they just didn't.
You've got a website set up now for him too, right?
Oh yeah, I'm working very hard on it. It's KennethArnoldUFO.com.
Are you having fun doing this too?
You know, it's really wonderful because even though over the years maybe I've had different opinions with my sisters, my younger sister and I are, you know, we're really proud, you know, that we're going to, you know, honor our father and that he will be a name now that will be remembered.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about
there
that.
Were four, George, there were four girls. He had four girls.
Right. Right. And my older sisters are much older. I have one who's 68 and one who's 65. And then I'm 57, and my younger sister is, you know, she's 55. So, anyway, yeah. I kind of have been the only one that's kind of, you know, been on this mission of trying to figure out or bring to closure my dad's historic sighting.
Do you remember if your father saw movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind or things like that?
Well, you know, he was kind of perplexed about that. And Paul and I kind of chuckled about that one because, you know, to him it was just amazing how, you know, no one came to him and asked him really how it all had started, really. And they just kind of did their own thing, and he was never even contacted, you know. So he was kind of, both my mother and dad were kind of, I remember them around the house thinking it was so odd, you know, that no one really cared about what he, what his perspective was on the whole situation.
I would have loved to have interviewed him.
Well, yeah, because Richard Dreyfuss was kind of really, in a way, being projected as my father.
Yeah. Yeah. Good old Richard. Yeah. Richard called in on the show once, and our producer hung up on him. Didn't believe who he was. Then he called back again and got hung up on again. But the third time, he convinced Tommy that that's who he was. Tom had to ask him some questions about his career, and he got them all right.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
Let's go to the phones. You two ready?
We're ready.
All right, let's go to Alex in Wichita, Kansas. We'll get you started here. Go ahead, Alex.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I've got a question for Tim.
Okay.
I've got a copy of the original book, and I bought it at a thrift store in 1997, and it's dedicated to the grandparents, and it's signed Kenneth Arnold. And I was wondering if there was a way to verify that that's authentic, or if somebody was trying to pull a fast one.
Now, what does the book say inside?
Is it just signed?
My grandparents, and then it states their name, and then it's signed Kenneth Arnold.
Oh, my God.
On the other side of the book, it has their name and address.
Well, don't give the address, but what names did he mention in the book there, Alex?
I can't remember.
Oh. That would have helped.
Yeah.
We'd be able to tell you instantly if
Kenneth Arnold. Well, I'll tell you the way you can probably verify that. You need to go to my website. It's KennethArnoldUFO.com, and I have actually posted in my website my dad's handwritten words to me and a copy of the book that he gave me. So all you have to do is look at the handwriting, and you'll be able to identify if it's authentic.
Are the people selling these things? What do you think, Kim?
What do you mean selling what?
These books.
Well,
signed by your dad.
The ones that people have, my dad autographed?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if there's really that many around anymore.
That's why it would be worth a fortune.
Pardon?
It would be worth a fortune to somebody.
Well, what's a fortune, George?
Yeah, really.
Huh?
You know what? If you're in the field, what a great book to have. A signed autographed book by Kenneth Arnold. That would be phenomenal.
Really? Well, actually, it is worth something, and it may not be in terms of money, but I have a vast library, an incredible library, and I have everybody's signature, including John Max.
You'd like one of these, Paula.
Yeah, but for me, because I'm a collector, because this is part of history, I have a historical perspective of ufology. The book is worth, it is worth quite a bit, but... You know, what I'd like to believe is that people are still reading.
Oh, I think they are. Reading. I think they are. They're great reads. I still have old Frank Edwards stuff running around.
Well, Leonard Stringfield's stuff is immortal. If anybody has, you know, Leonard Stringfield's original books, he was a great researcher, one of the original really good researchers.
He lived in Cincinnati, didn't he?
I think he lived on the East Coast somewhere near Ohio. I'm not sure, but I was.
Well, that's where Cincinnati is, close to Ohio.
Oh yeah, Cincinnati. I'm sorry.
It's in that state.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Stick to out of space stuff, Paula.
Yeah, I know. I was going to ask him though. Did Hynek ever get hold of your dad? Did he ever talk to him?
You know, Paula, the only time that my dad had any work and he had any kind of, you know, conversation with Hynek would have been at the 1977 UFO Congress where my dad was a keynote speaker.
What about NICAP, which was then the UFO group at the time out of Washington, D.C.? Do you know if he had any affiliation with them or whether they contacted him?
George, seriously? My dad just didn't really associate. I mean, just getting him to go to the International UFO Congress in 1977, boy, you know, Curtis Fuller had to pull a lot of strings just to get my dad to go.
Was that a first for him and only?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Did he enjoy himself?
Well, I'm sure that he enjoyed himself. He took my mother and I think one of my older sisters there. And, you know, I mean, you know, he did it as a public service, basically.
Let's go to Paducah, Kentucky, first-time caller. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, how's everybody doing?
Good, David. Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to the lady that's a non-family member, basically.
That's Paula,
According to the family member and other people's sightings, since, say, 75 years ago until now, do most of these shapes of these reported sightings, most of these shapes that are viewed, do they pretty much correspond in relation to one another? And then I also want to throw in there, if anybody's familiar with Hey There, Yogi Bear, I don't know what year that came out, but check that out. And there's a segment in there how the air traffic controller speaks to one of the airplanes in the air about seeing Yogi Bear on the windshield. And check that segment out, and that'd go real good with, you know, what could actually be happening in real life, like a plug back when that came out. And I'll take my response off there. Thank you.
Okay, in terms of shape, Paula, since the beginning, have they changed much? These UFOs?
I think so. The photographs I have from Europe are everything from cigar shape to orbs to very strange looking craft to Antonio Urzi, who is one of the contactees in Milano, is photographing biological looking things in everything from Adamski type. The Adamski type is a very interesting type of UFO, the ones with the balls underneath. And I think that they come in all shapes and sizes. And I really believe, George, and this is opinion I know, that there are many races visiting the Earth with many different vehicles. I don't think that there's one classic shape. And even the one that Kenneth Arnold saw was chevron-shaped.
Now, what's this hey there, Yogi Bear?
Well, I've never heard of that.
I didn't hear him say boo-boo.
Hey, that's right.
No, I never heard that.
It might have something to do with some kind of UFO sighting.
Well, you know, there are different synonyms for UFOs. I mean, the ones that were used by NASA, Santa Claus.
That's
right. There's different. And one of the interviews I did with Bill Kirkland, who was present during the Eisenhower landing at Holloman, he worked for NASA, I think, in Texas, and he said that the astronauts were told not to speak about plates or any kind of silverware or any kind of, dining utensils. And that's the way he said it, which meant flying saucers. Don't talk about saucers. So they couldn't say don't talk about flying saucers. So they said don't talk about anything that you dine with. So and it was very interesting because that's all that someone would need to say if it were monitored and they'd be giving away everything.
Who's telepathic in your family, Kim? Is it your mother?
You know, George, yeah, my mother was. My mother did have experiences with mental telepathy. She really did. And I didn't really understand them as a child. I thought, gee, here my dad saw UFOs, and my mother was kind of unique and different. But, you know, George, when I really got into my dad's files and I started doing all my research, I researched my family line. And to be honest with you, it is some kind of thing that it's hereditary. It's genetic. And it was passed down to me through my mother's family line. My grandmother, yes, from my grandmother's side of the family, my mother's side of the family. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Stephen in San Diego. Go ahead, Stephen. You're up with us.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. So I live in San Diego, and there's a mountain in San Diego called Mount Soledad. And directly about 10 miles northeast of Mount Soledad, there's been these orange glowing orbs that have been happening for the past, I'd say, 2 months, and I look at them in my telescope, and basically all I see is orange orbs going to other orange orbs.
So they're moving around, Stephen. And Stephen has moved around.
Yeah, he's gone.
An orb.
Well, actually,
him.
San Diego is where Adamski had sightings on Mount Palomar. They also had sightings on January 1st, a couple of years ago, that were very interesting over the water.
Can't these be plasma balls, though, Paula?
Yeah, they can. It's all of the above. Remember, George? It's all of it. Yeah, they could. They could. What's important, though, is that somebody take interest. Somebody cares. And that it get discussed scientifically.
Let's go to Ray in Washington, D.C. Hey, go ahead, Raymond.
Yes, sir. I'm a George. You have a fascinating show. I've been a big fan for 2 years. I have a thick notebook on all the fascinating people you have, and I've made so many notes. I've been listening to radio talk shows since the 1950s. I'm going to be 67 years old this month of January 2012, and I used to listen to Long John way back in the 50s when he used to get all these calls from around the country talking about UFOs, and it's amazing how, I guess the main question I'm getting to is that do the ladies think that the truth will come out connected with the Mayans, maybe because they were supposed to be extraterrestrials themselves, and I think the government has been, when I think Kim mentioned that her father knew somebody in the government that came out to visit Kenneth Arnold and warned him that if he didn't, if he said something, that he could be eliminated. And I just think that the government has covered up so many things. Obviously, UFOs would be only one of them.
So true, Paula. I don't think, and I'll say it again, there will ever be governmental disclosure. They will be whistleblowers, and I think they'll continue to come forward, don't you?
Absolutely. And Colonel Corsa used to say to me, Paula, when you mean government, who are you talking about? Because the government changes every 4 years or so. So we have to be careful to use that word to encompass a whole bunch of people in Washington, D.C., when I think this is being managed by a select group that are, you know, the ones that want to keep this secret. And it may be tied up with a military-industrial complex. It's not just government.
And it's worldwide, isn't it?
And it's worldwide, yeah. So it's just a group of people. If we can't call them MJ-12 now, but a group of people that figure it is not to their best interest to really take this seriously. And then bottom line, I think it's about the back engineered technology that we have, and it's about energy. And I think it's about the propulsion system, and I think it's about a lot of that stuff. It's not, I don't even think it's about aliens. I don't think it's about that.
Kim, did your mother ever say whether your father had nightmares or anything because of this?
No, my dad didn't. I don't believe my dad had nightmares about it. Well, probably in the beginning they did have nightmares about it, you know. But, no, I don't think he ever had nightmares about it. But, you know, it did deeply upset the family, that's for sure, you know.
Even though he stayed relatively quiet about all this, didn't he?
Well, definitely in the later years of his life, he was a recluse. It was amazing, really, that even you know, let a journalist in 1981 to interview him for the last time. So that was really quite amazing, really, because he just didn't do interviews.
No, he did that one early in 1947 after the sighting. Mm-hmm. They must have jumped all over him to get him in the studio.
Oh, it went on his whole life.
Yeah.
He was always getting calls from somebody, you know.
He never ended.
No, yeah,
I may have called him back in 1971.
Now, what did you say, George?
Back in 1971, I might have called him from Detroit to try to get him on.
Oh, you tried to get him too, huh, George?
Yeah, I did.
I
did. We were everywhere. Stay with us. Coming back with final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Whitley Strieber joins us on our next Coast to Coast program as we talk about his latest work, Solving the Communion Enigma. Get ready for that as he will discuss some cattle mutilations and strange implants as we continue with our two-part special series of reports on ufology. When we come back in just a moment with Paula Harris and Kim Arnold, we will take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Paula Harris, had you had the opportunity to chat with Kenneth Arnold, what would you have asked him?
Oh, I would have loved that because, you know, I really admire the people from our history. I would have asked him how it changed his worldview, exactly what I asked Steve Allen, the pilot down at Stephenville, because it does. It completely transforms a human being, and they see the world in a different way, and I would have asked him. Then I would have asked him, do you think the people should know? Do you think humanity should know? Which is what you asked me before.
Mm-hmm. I think we should know.
Well, I think we do. We wouldn't be doing this.
We have a right to know.
Yeah. If we didn't want to tell the people, it's very important that they know.
And Kim, what have you learned over the years, you know, reading your father's work and his files and just talking to other people. Have your views, and where are your views now on this?
Well, okay, what you and Paula were talking about a minute ago was very interesting. How it changed my father's view, it changed my father's view on death. That is what it did. It gave him hope that eternal life, or the life that we have when we are not in physical bodies, is probably more vast and more multidimensional and more incredible than we've ever had the ability to believe in, because it changed his view on death. He believed that the flying saucers, I said in the earlier part of the show, he believed towards the end of his life that it was a link between the living and the dead, and he believed in the fact that there were other worlds, and that at the time of death, he thought it was silly to think that we all sat up there and sat playing a harp next to God on a throne. He thought that there were other worlds and all kinds of activity and all kinds of interesting things going on.
Was he particularly spiritual?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, he believes in God, I think, more than anybody that I have ever known. But he didn't believe God was a man sitting in a throne. He didn't believe that. He believed God was some type of energy force. And if people go to my website, they will understand. I pretty much have explained that very clearly through his poems. I even have poems that are 77 years old in my father's files. I figured that out tonight. I thought that was pretty interesting. You know, I mean, things that I have here and that I actually put on the website for people to read. And it gives them a good insight as to my father's belief in God and how he really viewed the world.
Very good. Let's take some final calls here. We'll go to Philadelphia to get going. East of the Rockies. Hey, Will, go ahead.
Morning, Mr. Norrie. Matthias.
Hi.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Really, I'll try to make this as short as possible. I joined the United States Marine Corps. I served in Iraq and the Afghanistan wars. When I had returned, it was 2.5 years after coming back, I was diagnosed with a cancerous brain tumor on my right frontal lobe. From that point, it was the size of a silver dollar. In the course of that, I had had many CAT scans and many different things that were done to me. I rejected the radiation, but I had started with it. I was given the CAT scans in the 360s. In the course of the CAT scans, they had discovered there is a piece of metal embedded in my neck that is attached to my spine up in my neck, and it's so close to an artery that it cannot be removed. There is no scar on my neck. There is nothing of that sort.
And it's not shrapnel, is it?
It is not shrapnel. So no. There is no scar at all. From what the oncologist, what they had said is that it in size, that it appears to be completely, it is just about a half a centimeter in size and width, and then almost down to a quarter of a centimeter in the thickness of it. My question now is that ever since that, when I came back from the Marine Corps and I got out, I went to work for a certain branch of the government that is best left unsaid, but ones that you'd like to use three letters. And I worked basically under contract for them for about a year and a half. Now, since that point, I can be walking down the street, walking anywhere, and I've had cars pulled from me many times, and when they talk about Men in Black, these are not extraterrestrial, they're not. But basically, my question do you believe it's possible that I basically have some type of extraterrestrial
implant,
GPS unit in my neck?
Oh, you know, or Dr. Roger Lear, who's healing now, would be perfect for this because he'd probably want to see you. You might want to go to his website or just Google Roger Lear, Leir, alien scalpel, and send him an email address. Paula, you know, Roger's been very ill lately. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes, I heard that. I was very sad to hear that. He is an expert. He's one of the experts in this field, and I was going to say the same thing. George, he needs to see Roger Lear, and yes, there are similar cases like this.
They're there. They're absolutely there. Let's go to Ellsworth, Wisconsin, for First time caller. Alan, thank you for calling.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good.
So I got a really small UFO story.
All right.
And I'd like to share it with you.
Please.
Me and my three children were sitting at a Hudson Walmart store, finally checking out of the checkout. And we had walked out of the store and just got outside of the door when I stopped. And I noticed across the street there was a kind of a strip mall. And I stared across the street as I noticed something in the sky, somewhat really large, I guess. And I wasn't sure exactly what I was looking at. And it wasn't really making any noise, but I could tell it was some sort of a craft of some sort. And my children stood there looking at it, too. Well, one by one, through my peripheral vision, I began to see other people walking out of the Walmart store, and they also began to view what this was across the freeway. And there's a strip mall there, and it just kind of sat there for maybe about 8 minutes, 7 minutes, something like that, and then it began to slowly drift off to the left, which would be the west, and it moved over towards where the river was. And then all at once, it just kind of like cloaked or disappeared or just was gone. And we all just kind of looked at it and went, wow, I think we saw a UFO. And we were just like amazed. And then everybody kind of went their own way. And, you know, it's like, you know, the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life.
They're out there. There's many stories like that. Paula, have you ever seen a UFO?
Yeah, I was just going to say this. You know, all this took place near Mount Rainier, Mount Adams, and I have been to the East Seti Ranch, James Gilliland's ranch, and with a special kind of binocular. And, George, I think you've seen it too.
Ed Grimsley's night vision goggles.
Yes. Yeah. Well, night vision, James has night vision, and he hooked it up to a computer, so we saw it on a screen. Yes, we saw UFOs, and they were right near Mount Adams, and they were definitely not airplanes, and they were they'd power up, and they would do erratic movements.
And they'd stop, right?
And they'd stop, and yeah. I was very confused, because this is a whole other spectrum. These night vision glasses are very expensive, but if you can see, you can get a pair of these. And you go to places like, you know, Mount Adams or the East Seti Ranch or so forth, you will for sure see things.
It is bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because it's a whole other spectrum. It's not with the naked eye.
And they're not insects.
No, they're not insects. And they react. They react because there was a crowd of people, and they were kind of, talking to them or communicating with them, and whatever was out there was reacting by powering out the light. It's very fascinating, and I recommend that if people want to see it, they use this technology and they go to the East Seti Ranch.
Kim, when is your book out on your father's life?
Oh, okay, yeah, at Paula's convention. I'm very excited about going to her convention. I'm going to be the keynote speaker. It's the Women's UFO Symposium in Glen Rose, Texas, May 19th through 20th. And that's the date that I'm going to be releasing my book.
Excellent. So you're ready to roll?
Oh, of course I'm ready to roll. Yeah, it's time that I preserve my father's legacy for mankind.
Let's go to Victor in Manhattan in New York. Hi, Victor.
Oh, good morning, George. Good morning. First time caller, long time listener.
Thank you.
And good morning, Paul and Kim. I just read a Time Life book of mysteries, and it had a big thing on Area 51. And it was he was unnamed officer who worked there. He was responsible for retrieving the craft that the alien spaceship that crashed and all that kind of stuff. He didn't want to name himself because he says a lot of people disappear mysteriously. But my point is, Kim's father is very credible according to this story because he says. They have they captured a couple of aliens alive and all that kind of stuff. And they have rooms. They have many levels in Area 51. And they have one area where they had interrogation, and they were interrogating these aliens and all that. One died. I think a couple survived and all that. And they're not the only ones, according to this Army officer who worked there. And also, he said... what they were doing with the spacecraft. They were reverse engineering the whole thing, you know, after interrogating these aliens, getting information on that. The stealth bomber came out of that, and the black helicopters, Black Hawk helicopters, and a lot of other lasers, weapons,
yep,
and all that kind of stuff.
Sounds like Corso's story.
He also says there's an area on the floor where they have actual aliens working, you know, developing stuff. Actually, aliens there who've never seen the, you know, the light of day, but they're probably like prisoners, but working constantly, developing new sources of weapons, systems, and stuff like that. So Kim's father was right. They were alive. You know, they were alive.
And Paula, let me ask you, you've done some work in Area 51.
Yes, not in the area, but around that. I'm very, very fascinated. The Charles Hall story, I think, is viable. He is an ex-Air Force weatherman. If people need to read Millennial Hospitality, 1965, he said there were a group of tall white beings with their children there as guests. And that story is fascinating. The Dan Burrish story is fascinating. He was a microbiologist that dealt with one being in the Area 51 complex. And I think, you know, you have to take story by story by story of the original source. Because, George, all too often there's gossip and different kinds of, you know, stories out there that are not verifiable. And it gets all mixed up. So my way of dealing with it is my books are all word-for-word interviews with the original source, with the person that worked there, or the person that has a clearance or something. And that's the way I deal with this.
All right, let's go to Houston, Texas. Matthew, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. A lot of people, your guests, you have wonderful guests and a wonderful show, and I really appreciate it. I've studied so many of these books and CDs and DVDs and different things like that, and I've come to some conclusions. Can I give you some references?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Some of the books that I think would put this whole phenomenon together, the whole thing, one of the books is Above Black by Dan Sherman.
Yes.
Colonel Corso's book.
Day After Roswell, great book.
Right.
Frank Strange's book called Stranger at the Pentagon.
Yep.
Bill Cooper's DVD on the secret government, and a DVD called UFOs, Angels, and Gods. Basically, the secret government has been working with these aliens since 1947, and that's one of the reasons why they do not want us to know about it, is because they, like the gentleman before said, they're getting technology from these guys, and one of the exchanges was access to the population of the Earth and the animals for their purposes. And I believe one of the purposes that they're doing right now is a hybrid. And the reason for the hybrids is going to be a big deception that is going to take place in the future. They're going to release these hybrids with some big story that is going to be a big deception.
What do you think of that, Paula? Many have thought that.
Well, it's interesting. My feeling on hybridism is that could possibly be a scenario. The other one is that if we self-destruct, that's all that's left of us. I mean, if we really don't make proper decisions, the planet may not survive. And all you're going to have is hybrids of humanity. There won't be any humanity. So you can look at this in many different ways, but I'm so glad he mentioned those books. Because
they're all classics, too.
They're all classics, and people should read them.
Jacques Vallée, what do you think?
Oh, he has it together. Jacques Vallée has his act together. He has a very interesting point of view. He's not that public, but I'm so glad he shared the point of view. It's a dimensional point of view. It also says that whoever is observing this planet views us as a culture that is not anywhere near them. They almost look at us as ants. They're kind of cosmic anthropologists, and it's an interdimensional phenomenon, so it's deceptive. And I agree with Jacques Vallée in a lot of ways. I just wish he'd speak more. I'd love to interview him.
Well, he's been on our program, but you're right. He does not talk a lot. He goes to a very few conferences, but a brilliant mind. And, you know, basically Close Encounters of the Third Kind was also written with him in mind.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was done very, very intellectually. I mean, Francois Truffaut, who was a director, decided to take that part because I think he was interested. There's some very intellectual people interested in this phenomenon. And I admire Jacques Vallée.
Well, Paula, I want to thank you for being on the show and bringing Kim here.
Well, thank you, George, for having us. And I hope that people will read her book because this is part of history.
Paula's website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. Thank you so much. For Dave Buzinski, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.